The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster, along with my engineer producer, friend-engineer. He's my friend and engineer, Bob Dio, on the other side of the glass. And together, we welcome you to the Buckmaster Show. It's Thursday, May 30th, 2019. And I guess you'd have to be old enough to remember that today is the day we used to celebrate Memorial Day. This used to be the traditional day, May 30th. But of course, I don't know when it happened. And I think the 70s, they decided we're going to change all the holidays to give everybody, make it convenient for a three-day weekend. Listening to 1030 Tucson's voice for trusted local news and talk, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. Of course, we make it very easy for you to hear our program. If you can't hear it live, the podcast usually, thanks to my fine assistant, Rosemary Branch, usually gets it up within a couple of hours, certainly, of the conclusion of the program on the podcast at buckmastershow.com. The live line number, if you have any questions about climate, now would be a great time, 790-2040, to give us a call, because Zach Guido is with us. Zach is our expert on climate. He's UA climate scientist. He's also the Buckmaster Show contributor on climate. I'm so honored to have Zach and a team of over two dozen now regular contributors to the program. Zach is the program manager and research scientist for the University of Arizona's International Research and Applications Program and research affiliate at Climate Assessment for the Southwest at the UA Institute of the Environment. Is that the full intro, Zach? Did I
we have too many titles.
Too many titles, my goodness.
Climatologist. You can just call me climatologist.
Climatologist. Always good to talk with Zach. We're kindred spirits when it comes to travel. In fact, we were both in the West Indies in the Caribbean a couple of weeks ago. We were not there together. Zach was on the island of Dominica, not to be confused. Most people hear Zach, Dominica, you know what they think of, the Dominican Republic. Completely different. Dominican Republic shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti, but Dominica is in the Leeward Islands in the Caribbean. And I think, and I've been to every one of the 26 Caribbean basin nations, with the exception now of Haiti and Cuba, I think Dominica, I haven't seen it since that big hurricane.
That's right, Maria.
But I would say it used to be the greenest, luscious of all the Caribbean islands.
Yeah, that's their sort of claim. It's very forested. Not a lot of people. I think there's like just 100,000 people on the. It's a beautiful place. Not a lot of beaches, so it doesn't get a lot of that sort of Caribbean tourist travel. But very interesting nonetheless.
It has echoes to the South Pacific. It looks very much for folks that have been to Tahiti. It's a lot like that. Very mountainous, very green. They have not had a lot of tourism infrastructure in the past, but from what I understand, there are two major international resorts being built on the north end. Did you hear about
that? Yeah, I did hear about that. Okay. That's probably good for a lot of the locals there. I mean, I like it. I was there for work, but of course I like it because there isn't a lot of people there. That's sort of how I like to travel, but I'm sure that'll be a welcome part of their economy.
And they also have the largest Carib nation in the Caribbean. These are the original Carib people that have a settlement again up on the north coast. Mm-hmm. So that's very fascinating too. But you were there not for tourism. You were there for?
I was there. Most of the islands in the Caribbean are very climate vulnerable, as we saw in the last couple of years, particularly 2 years ago with Hurricane Maria and Irma, just really devastating a number of islands. Maria hit both Puerto Rico and Dominica, and I was there in part I'm working with an international group, public health people from Tulane University, people from Puerto Rico University, Colorado University, and we're working with stakeholders there in Dominica and in Puerto Rico to try to help them be more climate resilient. And what that looks like is trying to do some training, capacity building. We're trying to understand what their needs are. We're trying to understand the connections and the impacts, not just the direct impacts from climate events like hurricanes, but what are all the indirect impacts? And I'm not a public health person. I'm a mm-hmm. climatologist, as I said, but it is surprising all of the sort of pathways in which a climate event, whether it's a hurricane or whether it's just, you know, changes in seasonal temperature,
yes.
sort of ripple through the public health sector.
Mm-hmm.
It makes, for example, one thing that I thought was really interesting, and this is a sort of hurricane and, mm-hmm. and big event impact, but the people that need dialysis or the people that have insulin in refrigerators, mm-hmm. they're called those are sort of public health issues that are called grid sensitive. So
right.
when an event knocks out a grid.
For weeks,
it's those people that are impacted.
Big time.
Yeah.
And I just to share with you and our listeners, I was very curious. We've traveled to the Caribbean in over 40 years. One of the islands we really like is St. Martin. Mm. Part of it is Dutch. The airport is on the Dutch side. Then there's the French side. And of course, in September of 2017, Hurricane Irma, which the people on St. Martin say there were gusts, the highest gusts apparently ever recorded, totally destroyed one of the finest airports in the world at St. Martin. They're hoping to have it back up by December, but it's still a temporary structure. But what amazed my wife and myself, seeing all these yachts, talking multi-million dollar yachts, just still half submerged in the harbor. People have just decided they're not going to, you know, they're going to give up on it. And apparently something with maritime law, Zach, which I don't understand, says that the government can't go in and do anything with these boats. So they're,
wow,
just,
so
sitting,
they're just
there.
Sitting there.
They're
yeah.
sitting there. One of them is this massive yacht, and it still has the little dinghy attached to it, and it's all rusting out. It's just sitting there in the harbor at St. Martin. The owners have just given up on it. They also say that a lot of people who are on those yachts just disappeared. They do not know how many people died when Irma plowed through St. Martin, but they're still definitely doing a lot of rebuilding. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting story because I think it brings up a couple points. One, it's like the people that, you know, have the yachts, they're also probably the ones that have insurance.
Yes.
And those yachts are probably sitting there, but yeah. you know, financially they probably got some compensation for it. But there's still a lot of people, probably the majority of people and the locals that aren't insured. And
right.
and when you have these big events that damage their, you know, their housing or prevent them from going to work, it's like yeah. those are the ones that have the impacts last, you know, years, if not longer.
Yeah, most people are not insured, and businesses were not insured on St. Martin. But the one hotel that really was overinsured on the French side in the little village of Grand Case, and if people want to see my Facebook page, we've got all sorts of pictures that we posted of the rebuilding going on at the Grand Case Beach Club. You got to hand it to the owners. They were 120% insured. Everybody stayed on the payroll. They came to work for a year and a half. The maids weren't cleaning rooms. They were cleaning up the debris, and they are rebuilding. 48 of the 78 units now have been redone. And it's really, you got to hand it to the owners because everybody stayed on payroll. Nobody lost any money out of the deal. And what's emerging there is a beautiful state-of-the-art facility. But that's an unusual story.
Yeah, it's also interesting. While the frequency of these big events, like hurricanes, are not, there's no statistically significant trends in that. But what is changing is the cost of the damage, and that's a reflection of, you know, our society is becoming wealthier, one, but also like building in ways that worsen or deepen the vulnerability and the sensitivity to these kinds of events. The other thing I wanted to say is not only is it difficult to sort of quantify how many people were actually killed directly and indirectly, mm-hmm. but there was also a lot of out-migration.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people left Puerto Rico, for example, and which is what I'm a little bit more familiar with, and I'm sure some of those that were in on the other mm-hmm. islands that were affected
yeah.
as well. And then when we were flying into Puerto Rico, it was, you know, the damage of Maria was so obvious because you could look down as you're flying overhead and see all of the blue tarps on a lot
still
of the houses.
The roofs, yeah.
So people are like the roofs. They're the roofs of the individuals are still, you know, blue tarps. So there's and obviously this has been in the news, and I think many people are well aware of you know, the rebuilding and the slowness of it and just all of that around Puerto Rico. But yeah, these islands in the Caribbean are certainly exposed to hurricanes and tropical storms.
Another thing they're exposed to now are miles and miles of brown seaweed. That's all we saw flying over the Caribbean. When we come back with Dr. Zach Guido, what is going on? Why is this crisis? And it is a crisis on the Mexican, what they call the Mexican Riviera of Cancun, that area. Piles and piles of seaweed. Moody's, the credit agency, today put out a warning for Mexico. There'll be a dramatic hit in tourism because of the seaweed crisis in the Caribbean. Is it linked to climate change? We'll ask Dr. Guido about that. But first, Zach, I want to tell folks about my favorite bakery in town. You've heard this before.
I like it too.
You like it too. Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's located northeast corner, Swan and Sunrise. It's a great place to stop by right now, have a sandwich, or they'll still do breakfast for you. They start breakfast at 6:30 in the morning now. They've got the new grill in, everything up to speed. Mona'sDanishBakery.com is their website. There's also a link. They're one of our great partners. So all the partners are at BuckmasterShow.com. Have them all listed there for you and very convenient links. So it's Mona's Danish Bakery, northeast corner, Swan and Sunrise. Another great partner that's linked up at BuckmasterShow.com, Green Things. By the Rito River. They're at 3384 East River Road, 13-acre site with every imaginable plant that you could think of. Buy all my roses there at Green Things, and of course all the merchandise at Zocalo, all that great merchandise from Latin America, Mexico, is at Zocalo, and that's part of the Green Things family. So, great partners, Green Things, and Mona's, just a couple of the people and businesses that make our show possible. We'll be back with Dr. Zach Guido. If you'd like to join the conversation, and we encourage you to do so, 790-2040. Be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. The Regional Transportation Authority has a 35-member Citizens Advisory Committee working to identify transportation priorities for the region and will be seeking public input on those priorities before too long. These priorities will help guide development of an RTA continuation plan. The current RTA plan and half-cent excise tax will continue through June 2026. To learn more, please visit rtamobility.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I'm passionate about travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. And when I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport. With 9 airlines flying nonstop to 22 destinations and easy one-stop connections, I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient with competitive airfares, and there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Climate scientist Dr. Zach Guido, who is the Buckmaster contributor on science, joining me in studio. And before the break, Zach, we were talking about all the seaweed issues in the Caribbean. Does this have more to do perhaps with ocean currents or the warming of the Atlantic?
Yeah, so that's crazy. I hadn't heard the news. I mean, you were referring to
what's going on in Mexico.
Yeah, and I guess I did a little research. You prepped me on this before. Mm-hmm. And as one might expect, there's less known about seaweed changes as a function of warming temperatures. But what people sort of do know is that seaweed is pretty vulnerable to changes in the temperature in the ocean, and also chemical changes. And those are sort of indirect effects, or actually direct effects of climate change. So one might expect there to be something going on with seaweed populations. I think what people think now, more so than sort of changes in populations, is changes in the sort of biogeography or the distribution. There's a whole bunch of variability in the ocean, currents, as you mentioned, localized temperature change. So I'm not sure if it's a climate signal. I would say it's the right question to ask. I mean, I think when it comes to climate, I mean, we're doing such a monumental, huge disruption to a fundamental part of our Earth system, the atmosphere. And we would expect that changes in the atmosphere, which, by the way, the warming that we're experiencing in the atmosphere is just a fraction of what we're also seeing in the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the warming temperature in the air that we're seeing as a consequence of global climate change, but it's also in the oceans. So it's the right question to ask in the sense of, well, what is this big, you know, perturbation doing to our environment? And as I understand it, there's a ton of research trying to figure this out, because seaweed and other plankton are really critical components of the ecosystem.
Let's bring it back home. Both of us being away, we missed some great May weather here in Tucson. I will tell you, our first morning back late last week, I couldn't believe it. I opened the door up in the morning. It felt like mid to late October.
It was great. I know. It was like winter in May, and that's a treat.
And no 100 degree temperatures,
right,
which is kind of unusual, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple years ago, 2016, we didn't reach 100 in May either. So that's not that unusual, let's say. But right now it is. If you look at the average maximum temperature, so the average of all the high temperatures during the month of May, and we're running in second place right now. And Phoenix is running in fourth place out of, you know, going back to 1950 data at the Tucson Airport and the Phoenix Airport. But what's also interesting is that the years that are ahead of us currently are in the 50s for 53 in Tucson and a couple in the 50s and one in the 70s in Phoenix. And
which is interesting, because normally, lately, we've been judging our weather records, it seems like, kind of the last 20, 25 years, and anything older, that was before all the pavement and everything, and the global, not global, but the heat island effect here.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's like we're running close to first, and competing with years that didn't have the sort of global warming signature that we now have. So that puts it even more into perspective. So, and then if you look last year at May, the average temperature here at Tucson Airport, the average maximum temperature, so the high temperature, was around 94 degrees Fahrenheit. This year it's around 84. Mm-hmm. So that's 10 degrees different. So you can imagine how... Mm-hmm. I mean, 84 being the average high is quite pleasant. And a lot of the lows, you know, got down into cool conditions, which you know, often happens in May, but you know, we're running, we're running a lot below average right now. So, and I would say also that, you know, when you look at 100 degree temperatures, no, we haven't had one. Mm-hmm. And even if you go down to 95, we've only had two.
Right.
Above 95. And that's, there's only been one or two other years in the record that has had those few of days. So
well, there are all sorts of implications here. I was talking to some friends over in the San Luis Obispo area today, and Big Sur, that area. They're getting a ton of rain. They've had a ton of rain this spring, which is great news because maybe this would be the first year that we do not have these massive California wildfires.
Right.
The snowpack, they're saying they'll be skiing up at places like up at Lake Tahoe over to the 4th of July. So there are a lot of interesting things going on weather-wise this year.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the cool conditions, you know, as you said, you know, makes the snowpack persist, that dampens the risk of a fire. Also with lower temperatures, it doesn't as rapidly dry out the vegetation. So there's a positive impact on fire risk. So that's nice. There's also a positive impact on drought conditions. Arizona is relatively drought free. In fact, another sort of U.S. wide story is if you look at the drought picture, it's one of the lowest, one of the least area is occupied by moderate or more severe drought in the U.S. than in its history. So it's
wow.
Yeah, and in the last 6 months, U.S. wide, it's been, you know, the fourth wettest on record. So there's been a lot of cool and wet conditions over the winter, not just in Arizona, but U.S. wide. So that's it's pretty interesting.
Of course, Zach Guido, the monsoon is coming. Normally, it can start anywhere around last week of June, up until maybe 2 weeks into July. With all this strange weather, unusual weather, we'll put it that way, I wonder how it will impact getting the thunderstorms fired up. Because as I recall, Zach, you got to have enough heat to get that going.
That's right. Yeah, I think this is going to be interesting. We're also in a weak El Nino. I can talk about that in a little bit. But there is an idea out there. You know, we don't have long records, and there's a lot of variability. So statistically, it's hard to sort of assess. But there is an idea that sort of a cooler spring leads to a later onset. And then if you have just, you know, a week or 10-day delay in the onset of the monsoon, you know, you take, you know, 10% of your time away from getting rain. And so that correlates with lower precipitation over the monsoon season. So again, those statistics aren't strong, but one may, we'll watch. We'll see if the cooler conditions, more snowpack, prevents the high pressure ridge from developing and allowing really the monsoon ridge to form and that monsoon to fire up around, as you said, around the sort of the 1st of July. It's kind of hard to say. I mean, I gave up predicting the monsoon. The official NOAA predictions are usually they sort of flip a coin, and when they do give,
don't they have a dartboard where they throw?
It's a really hard thing to forecast because there are so many variables at play in the monsoon, and I think this is underappreciated. The Southwest monsoon is really a Mexican. It's where the heart of it is in Sonora, Mexico. Yeah. And so we're on the northern fringes of it, and consequently, we're more subject to other phenomenon and events that can just sort of knock around the monsoon a little bit and make it, you know, make it fire up one day or not. So we're more sort of, it's more variable up here.
It's a tropical visitor.
Yeah. It's a great one. It's yes. A great one. I mean, the monsoon brings a lot of exciting weather. It also brings a lot of floods and danger. And, you know, at the beginning of the monsoon, it's sort of the height of our fire season because that's when you get a lot of lightning strikes. So it also ironically sort of works to dampen the fire risk. So in the beginning of the monsoon, more fire risk because of the ignitions. And then, you know, a week, 2 weeks into it, when, you know, the rain start in earnest, then it sort of dampens that risk.
All right, we've got a minute left. The El Nino, La Nina, I never know where we are with that. Is that playing into what kind of the weird weather in the West, certainly?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've been talking with my colleagues, and we're really trying to figure out what has caused the May and late April conditions. And we think there has been an El Nino, and that can, at times, can allow for more of a wandering jet stream and allow for sort of these low pressure systems to set up, which has been more persistent in May than otherwise would be. So May is a variable month to begin with, and there is this background state of a weak El Nino that is maybe tugging at the atmospheric strings a little bit. There's other things going on too, which we won't get into, but there's like a Madden-Julian oscillation in the tropical Pacific as well, that when it's in certain places, it has impacts on weather here in the West. So there's all of these combinations that are going on. I would say that maybe there is some weak association between the El Nino and the weather, but there's also just a lot of weather variability in May to begin with. And, you know, I think we should just be thankful and take it.
Yeah, I'll take it any day.
It was a great
any day.
Yeah.
All right, Zach Guido, Dr. Zach Guido is the Buckmaster Show contributor on climate. He's also the only person I know who has visited Mongolia. Mm. So that certainly scores high marks with a traveler like myself. He's got Mongolia on me. Anyway, Zach, always a pleasure to see you. We'll bring you back in again once we do get cranked up with the summer thunderstorm season. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, that Buckmaster Show, 10:30, the voice trusted local news and talk. David Safir is in the house. David writes about education at TucsonWeekly.com. We have a lot to talk about. The freshly minted legislative session and budget. How did education finally make out when all was said and done? That will be one of the questions I'll have for David as we continue on a Thursday. It's Buckmaster since 2011 on 10:30, the voice.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
Let's say you need an honest roofer. Where do you start? Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona has more than 3,200 accredited businesses ready to help and committed to doing things right. Next time you need a trusted mechanic, plumber, AC company, or florist, go to our website, bbb.org, or call us at 520-888-6161. Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona. We are here to help you find local companies you can trust.
This is Moa Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing.
And this is Bill Buckmaster. For several decades now, Moe has been my go-to expert for all my framing needs and bathroom mirrors. I trust Moe for service, professionalism, and top-of-the-line quality.
Thanks, Bill. Give us a call at 795-8226 and stop by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing on the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge, right next to Copenhagen, and on the web at moesgallery.com.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year, and if you are over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show on 1030 Trusted Local News and Talk. I'm Bill Buckmaster, one of our contributors. We heard from Zach Guido. He's our climate contributor. David Safir, he's our blog contributor, but mainly also specializing in education. David writes at TucsonWeekly.com about education. And David, it's always good to see you.
A pleasure to be here, Bill.
And we were just visiting a little bit during the break about how Zach and I were very much talking about geography and weather and all those things. And we were visiting that your geography is not one of your strong suits.
Well, it's interesting. As a teacher, and I taught high school English, it's very important to understand, I think, that students aren't being resistant or belligerent or obstinate when they say, I'm just having trouble reading this.
Right.
So you really understand that it is a problem. And one of the ways I understand it is I have a terrible spatial sense. Now, I can do science, and I can do math, and I can do English, but ask me to put the states on a map or the countries in Europe, and especially Eastern Europe, and I will be well below average simply because for some reason I have a disability there. It doesn't hurt me in terms of my life, but it's important to know that if I have that disability, then other kids who can't scan the written page because their eye jumps around, it doesn't stay in one place, and all kinds of other things that are attributed to this dyslexia, kind of an overview, that's just kind of a general term, they're real. And those kids who say, I have trouble reading, you've got to understand that. And I was telling you earlier, I would tell my students who are like this, I said, you know, you're always going to have trouble reading. There's not going to be any magic bullet.
Yeah.
You can do it.
Yes.
But it's going to take you twice as long. It's going to be twice as hard. And if you want to do that, you can read anything you want, but it may not be fair. It's going to be harder for you than someone else. And that was just not being cruel. That was being honest, telling them they can do it, but making them realize that it's going to be a struggle.
And that was what I learned early on about math. I can barely to this day balance a checkbook. Not real good with numbers. But what is it about in the whole education and learning situation? Is it genetic that pulls us in one direction or another?
We've got the whole nature-nurture argument that goes forever.
But when it comes to geography, I can list off all 26 Caribbean Basin nations. I can list the Leeward Islands from north to south. But when it comes to some numbers, problem.
All I can say is that you've either got something built into your body that's there, you know, you're hardwired for able to do that, and I am not, or something had happened from birth till 5 years old, push you in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I will lean towards a whole lot of nature on that, that these kids who have a dyslexic situation or kids who have other kinds of sometimes social emotional problems that go towards the autism syndrome or something like that, that's hardwired. It doesn't mean you can't do anything about it, but the first thing you have to do is say, this is real, not like, oh, just brush it off. It's not real. It really is real, and that's important to know.
David Safir with us writes about education at TucsonWeekly.com, the column that is known as The Range. The final legislative budget went over the Memorial Day weekend. I think the lawmakers decided, well, we want to get this done, and they did. So let's zero in on your area of interest and expertise, education. When all is said and done, was it a good year for Arizona education?
Well, it was a mixed year, and the only way I think to look at it is go back historically, all the way back to the Great Recession to see this. So the thing that looks good, and the reason people say, wow, education really made out, is they got $136 million more in assistance, $20 million for counselors or security officers for school safety, $130 million for teachers' raises, $30 million for results-based funding. I just mentioned $300 million, and that sounds like schools really did well. After that money is in, schools are still approximately $1 billion below where they were in 2008. When you factor in the number of students, we have more students. When you factor in inflation, we still have $1 billion left. We put ourselves in such a phenomenal hole. And Governor Ducey, who loves to call himself the education governor, well, he's got a history he's got to answer for. So this goes back before him. 2008, Jan Brewer was in office. She was our governor. And people said we had to make cuts, and we really did. You know, the Great Recession was there. But education looks like a huge slush fund. You know, this year, the education budget is between $5 and $6 billion. $5 and $6 billion. It's a huge amount of money. So if you need to get money, that's where the money right. is. So they took money from there and they said, we have to do it. And they kind of sort of did have to do it. But you know, Bill, you remember that they leased some buildings out or kind of sold the building.
At the Capitol.
They could have done more of that if they wanted to, but they cut it off and said, this is enough and we'll cut education. Well, Jan Brewer, who I didn't especially like, did a couple of wonderful things. And one thing she did is she said, we need more money for education. And she supported a 1 cent sales tax hike that went to the voters and passed by like 64% yes or something like that. And that wasn't the thing that Republicans were supposed to do. She did it. It brought $600 or $700 or $800 million more in a year, which was good. But it was only for 3 years. After 3 years, they tried to pass it again. Our own Annie Peterson here in Tucson was one of the people who was spearheading it. But Doug Ducey, who then was the treasurer of the state, was the chairman of the campaign against the 1 cent sales tax hike.
Yeah.
He was.
In 2010, wasn't it?
2012 is okay. when that was.
Okay.
And he got a whole lot of money from, if people know the name of the Koch brothers, the very, very super rich oil magnates who are very, very conservative libertarian. He got lots of money from them at the last minute that kind of pushed the initiative out. So were it not for his efforts, it's very possible we would have continued the money from Brewer and we would be in a better situation than we were. So let's go to 2015. That's 6 or 7 years after the original cuts and more cuts on top of those cuts. I shouldn't say all the states, 2/3 of the states had cut money by then. And so people started looking, how much was cut? I thought in my memory, I remembered that Arizona had cut something like 22% to 24% from the 2008 level. And I went back a couple days ago and looked, and I was wrong. It was 36%.
Whoa.
We cut the most of any state in the nation. The next was at about 22%. Now, we're not the only state that's hurting for money. We're not the only state who kind of went in the tank economically. But somehow we decided that we had to continue cutting education funds. So at that point, in 2015, we were about $1.5 billion in the hole below it was in, what it was in 2008. And I'd already been writing about education in Arizona for about 5 years before that. And I'd always been saying, we don't have enough money for education. We're down in the cellar in terms of per student funding. And we dug ourselves deeper in the hole. So figuring all that in and all the things that are going on and some more money coming into education, it's not enough. It's not fast enough. And if they said we had no choice but to cut it, this year, Bill, when we had more tax money coming in than they expected, when the Trump tax cuts at the national level brought us about $300 or $400 million extra from that area, when the rainy day fund was lower than right. we wanted it to be, but still existed, if we were playing we have no choice, Arizona has no choice but to give back to the students what they took. And remember, 2008, those first graders, they're graduating this year. They've had their whole school career without that money. And we should say that cannot stand for once we have the money to do it, we can spend more, but we gave back the tax increase and we put more money in the rainy day fund so Ducey can brag that he has $1 billion there. And I think from that standpoint, we really messed up. So if anybody tells you all the wonderful money that Ducey put in there, it was too little And right now it's much too late. We need a whole lot more infused into education.
But the public perception that Red for Ed a year ago gave teachers a lot more money, that's what many people think.
Well, it did. Teachers got, I don't know if they actually got a 10% raise, but they were supposed to have gotten a 10% raise. Enough money was put in. This year, another 5%. Next year, another 5%. But teacher raises only make the world more comfortable for teachers. In other words, it means that people aren't living in dire poverty like so many teachers virtually are living at the edge of poverty right now. So we made that better. But other than making teachers somewhat more contented and possibly keeping more of them in the classroom, it doesn't fix the AC in the building. It doesn't fix the roof. It doesn't take care of the buses. It doesn't put more supplies or more computers. So while that's good, that's only one part of the billion-dollar question, a billion-dollar question we have in front of us.
More with David Safir. Call us at 790-2040 if you'd like to join in the conversation. If there's something that David said you don't agree with, he'd be happy to hear from you. If something he said you agree with, call us anyway. Favorite bakery in town is Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. They're doing lunch right now at Mona's on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Steve, the chief baker and owner, has made a huge investment in his new grill so they could do the hot breakfast. And at 6:30 each morning, they are open and ready to give you a wonderful breakfast. Been up there now many times since they have launched that about a month and a half ago. The morning breakfast getting underway at 6:30, northeast corner Swan and Sunrise. Right now, lunch, or you can do breakfast. Go to monasdanishbakery.com. There's a link also at buckmastershow.com, not only to Mona's, but all of the great partners that we have on our program. We'll be right back on Buckmaster on 1030, trusted local news and talk. Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year transportation plan is funded through June 2026 by a special taxing district, which is a state-established political subdivision within Pima County. The RTA plan and half-cent excise tax were voter-approved in May 2006, and the tax is collected within the district. More about RTA Citizens Advisory Committee's efforts to develop an RTA continuation plan at rtamobility.com.
Hey, it's Matt Russell from The Buckmaster Show.
And this is Ryan Hansen from Bon Voyage Travel.
I am so pumped to be partnering with Bon Voyage on my next culinary and cocktail cruise.
This is definitely a cruise for foodies as you experience the Mediterranean on Celebrity Cruises.
And the private excursions that your team has arranged for us? I mean, come on, an ouzo distillery tour in Greece? A food and wine day on Malta?
We'll handle everything, so all you and your guests need to do is eat, drink, and be happy.
Go to bvtravel.com/Matt Russell to learn more.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, Thursday edition, 10:30 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Tomorrow, 24 hours from now, we'll have the mayor with us in studio. Mayor Rothschild will be with us along with Tim Steller, columnist for the Arizona Daily Star. This portion of Buckmaster presented by Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. All sorts of activities this summer going on, just a three-hour drive. Coming up immediately is the Wild Wild West Pro Rodeo, June 12th through the 15th in Silver City. So that's one of the activities. If you're into that, that would be a great opportunity to go over and visit in Silver City. The starting place, southwestnewmexico.org. There you'll learn about great places to stay and all sorts of recreation opportunities. David Safir is with us, TucsonWeekly.com columnist at the section they call The Range, which covers pretty much everything from A to Z. David is covering pretty much the stuff that revolves around E, education. And here we are about a year into the new superintendent of schools. Six months.
A little under 6 months,
under
right.
6 months.
Yeah.
Okay. How is she doing compared to, say, her predecessor 4.5 years ago into Diane Douglas's first form?
Well, it's interesting because we talked a lot about Diane Douglas at the beginning of her term, because here she was a strong conservative, seemed mm-hmm. like she was going to be pushing a very, very hard line when she came into office, and she didn't, as a matter of fact. You and I talked about this. She took her job, I think, very seriously.
She did.
And tried to represent all the students. Unfortunately, when Donald Trump began running, she kind of got in touch with her inner wingnut conservative, and then from that point, it was over. But before that, I thought she'd done a good job. So I wrote about her a lot, because this was a surprise, and I was one of the few people on the progressive side who actually found something to compliment her about, and she and the people up in the Department of Education were actually quite appreciative of that, I found mm-hmm. out. I didn't know it originally. But I haven't talked about Kathy Hoshman or written, because I kind of sort of expected her to be good right out of the block. Here, she's a progressive Democrat. She's a teacher. She's very energetic. She's got a lot of stuff going for her. And so I guess I adopted a wait-and-see attitude. But now I can say I think she's doing a really, really very, very good job. She's got a nice, deft touch. It's like a teacher knows how to reach out to everybody in the classroom. Well, she speaks her mind, but she doesn't do it in a way that is overly corrosive. So everybody in the classroom, her classroom now being the state, can listen to her, and whether they agree or disagree, they can get the sense that there's a real kind of an energy and a good purpose behind it. She's never been in office before. She's mm-hmm. in her early 30s, which makes her rather young and inexperienced, but I'm surprised with how well she has taken care of things. And she's had a few issues that has been very nice that they kind of broke at the time when she came in, because she was able to support them. I don't know if they would have happened otherwise. For instance, there was what was called the, and I hate to use this term, except it's a term that was always used, and she used it, the no promo homo law, which was a law that dated from, I don't know, the 80s or 90s, which mm-hmm. said you couldn't say anything positive about what they called a, and I'm putting this in quotes, homosexual lifestyle. Uh-huh. It's not a lifestyle. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's something beyond that. But that's what it said. She said flat out that that is a terrible idea. She, in her state of the education message, she said it was outdated, harmful, and wrong. There was no question about it. Well, that's gone now. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give her too much credit, because there was a lawsuit, and the Attorney General Brnovich said he wasn't mm-hmm. going to support the lawsuit. So it looked mm-hmm. like it was going out. But she gave it legs, and she gave it prominence. And by what she talked about, it got out into the media more. I think people paid more attention to it. And that's good. Remember, she doesn't make laws. She has this huge budget. You know, I just told you it was $5.5 billion she oversees. But everything she does beyond overseeing the budget is a matter of, you know, getting up on her bully pulpit and saying things. So she's been helpful that
way.
And
she's been in the trenches. I think she's was a special ed teacher up in the Phoenix area. And so I don't know when we had a superintendent a real teacher in that position, but it's been a while.
The answer is it's been 30 years, okay, over 30 years since we even had an educator. Yeah. David Garcia would have been an educator, right, but not a K-12 teacher. Mm-hmm. So I always think that when people like Tom Horn or John Hoopenthal, mm-hmm, or Diane Douglas, when they visit a school, it's almost like they're visiting a foreign country. Oh, right, they visited when they were kids, right?
Yeah,
they
knew that.
But they were there haven't as visited students since then, and they don't really understand it, so there's kind of a gee-gosh about it. Mm-hmm. When she walks in there, she's back home. Mm-hmm. She looks at it from a standpoint of a teacher, and she can see when things are, don't have, when one school doesn't have enough in terms of resources compared to another school. She can see how things are going, and that makes a great deal of difference. And I actually haven't heard much from teachers, but I certainly haven't heard any negative words. And I think they're pleased that someone with her background is there holding down the fort. She's done one thing she did. You know, this is important, and this is supposed to be a first. She is appointing, and I don't think she's hired this position yet, an associate superintendent in charge of equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Hmm.
And it says that his mission or her mission will be driving the Department of Education's internal and external efforts to better serve underrepresented, marginalized, and at-risk students and their families. Hmm. Well, everybody talks about this, but she says, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to appoint someone at the associate superintendent level whose job it will be to monitor this, to make suggestions. This is really an important step, and apparently it's somewhat of a unique step, at least to have someone with that much authority in the Department of Education around the country. That's a very, very good thing. It's more than lip service. And, you know, when I badmouth the Republican legislature and the governor about education, and I think they deserve it, if you look at virtually everything they do, in every way, it's making the rich and comfortable, or the kids who are rich and comfortable, better accommodated and more comfortable in the schools, and the other ones, the rest of the population, whether they are different ethnicity or whether they're lower income, those people kind of get the leftovers. And what Kathy Hoffman is saying is, not on my watch. If I can help it, we're going to look at what's going on with those kids. And I have a great deal of respect for that kind of attitude.
She has a huge job, though, ahead of us, her trying to get the infrastructure in our schools back where it should be.
Oh, and to be honest,
we talked earlier about teacher salary, which is great that the teachers are getting the additional money, but I'll tell you, some of these facilities are very bad.
But I don't hold that against her, because she doesn't have a vote in the legislature.
Right.
She complained about it. She said, we've got to get it back to pre-recession levels after the budget passed. So there we have it. You know, but as much as she can do, I think she's going to do it. And things that she can do on her own watch, and there are always things within the school system you can do when you're in charge of the school system, I have hopes that good things will happen. They won't bring in more money, but maybe it will be distributed in a way that's going to be more valuable to the kids who need it most in the state.
We've got to do something about the teacher shortage.
Absolutely. And, there are any number of reasons why that's a problem, but money is only one of them. And the other is, we just got to get people here supporting education and stop knocking schools. It seemed like maybe there was a turnaround with the Red for Ed movement, where it scared Republicans seeing 50,000
teachers
out the door.
Where some were calling public schools government schools.
Government schools and failures. And all of a sudden they started saying, we value the teachers. Well, maybe they had to say it and they'll go back to their old ways. But maybe we're getting a little bit of a turn, I hope.
All right, David Safir, we'll look for your work at TucsonWeekly.com, the column in The Range, everything from A to Z at The Weekly. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Bill.
David Safir, on behalf of David and Mr. Dio, Bob Dio, on the other side of the glass. Great job again, Bob. I'm Bill Buckmaster. Jennifer English, her show Around the Table, coming up next on 10:30, The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Have a great afternoon.